You know, I want to get into immigration. Thank you for like bringing up this topic and following my Twitter stream, because it is, you know, big on my mind. And I know people like to know what I'm thinking, and I like to share what I'm thinking. Why do I like to share what I'm thinking, Alex? People email me, jason@calacanis.com is my email for life, or they DM me and tell me that I'm a horrible person. And, you know,
dude, you got to lock down your DMs.
I love it. I'm not locking my DMs. I love the savage DMs I get. It's incredible.
Okay.
You don't like them. I know. I tweet them out.
I'm just like, I can only take so much. I think I have a slightly lower bar for negativity day to day than you do. I just like, after the third or fourth time someone calls me something nasty, I'm just like, all right, that's enough for today.
It's strictly a reflection on how they're feeling about themselves at that moment.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
And usually it's a troubled person or a 12-year-old or a Russian Chinese bot trying to cause trouble or just somebody doing engagement farming in order to make money, you know?
Yeah.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Paddle. Self-serve software is global by default, but selling to every country is complicated. Paddle's merchant of record manages payments, sales tax, chargebacks, and refunds, so you don't have to. Wherever you want to take your business, go there with Paddle. Go to paddle.com/twist to get started with your exclusive listener fee-free period. Fitbod. Tired of doing the same workouts at the gym? Struggling to plan your own workouts? Fitbod will build you personalized workouts that help you progress with every set. Get 25% off your subscription or try out the app for free when you sign up now at fitbod.me/twist. And LinkedIn ads. Start converting your B2B audience with high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/thisweekinstartups to claim your credit. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. It is January 3rd, 2025. We are here in the new year. I'm still in Tahoe getting in some skiing. I did 16 full days. I took my first day off. I'm trying to beat my record of 40 days, which I did, I think, 3 years ago.
All right.
My second best year was 36. So I'm currently ahead of my two best years. I track it with an incredible app called Slopes. So I want to shout out Slopes. If you don't have Slopes and Open Snow and you're a skier, please go buy those too. I'm not an investor in either. But yeah, I'm just having a wonderful time. Had a restful, great time with my daughter, skiing a ton. And I got to ski with Chamath and Freeberg. We're all on this sort of vacation to Tahoe. Not in the same house, but in the same area. And so a wonderful, wonderful, restful holiday. How was yours, Alex? How was your rest holiday? Was it restful?
It was full of food, but because we had a 3.5-month-old during most of it, not super restful. But I think that's just par for the course when you have really little kids, so not a complaint. I got to see my brother, who actually, he's living in Austin for another 6 months on assignment.
Oh, I'd love to meet him. Yeah, what does he do?
I'll see what I can do. He's a major in the Army, and he just completed his PhD in applied physics and is going back to West Point to teach.
Wow, respect. Well, when we have our next event, we'll invite him. I do like some CEO dinners and VC dinners on Thursday nights in Austin. Every Thursday, I invite 5 people to come have dinner with me. I got some regulars, and then I always invite like a new person to have like wide-ranging discussions because I love people.
Yes, you do.
I love doing this show. Let's say hi to some of our folks who have tuned in early. Mark Beatles, our first Noti coming in today. Campbell, Noti Squad. Bernie Hepp. Happy New Year, all. He was our third. Michael Dan Moisson-Sohn. He is also part of the Noti Gang Squad, whatever. I think Noti Gang is good. Maddie Newman, our producer and researcher in Austin. She's here. You don't get to be in the... Well, you can be in the Noti Gang, sure. Uzi Obi is here. Yes, I'm alive. Thank you. It's a little dark. Gregory Kennedy, Homestead Creative. And a bunch of other people are here. We always like to shout out the Noti Gang. What's the Noti Gang? Those are the people who put on notifications on YouTube. Go to YouTube, type in This Week in Startups, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We will be going live at about 10 a.m. Pacific.
Yes.
Noon, J-Cal, J-Ranch time in Texas, and 1 p.m. Alex time on the East Coast.
Actually, Jason, before we jump into our first chart and our first story, because you brought up the time we do the show, would you like to tell people how the next couple of weeks are going to be slightly different?
Oh, yes. I am going to be traveling internationally for 10 days. So we might start earlier or later?
Earlier. I think it's couple 8 a.m. Eastern time next week. We'll confirm that. Put it in the newsletter.
No, 8 a.m. Eastern time. Okay, yes. Which means 5 a.m. Pacific time. I mean, so if you get up for the Noti Gang, you're going to have my absolute Salute to you. So yeah, when I'm on the road, I still want to do live.
Hell yeah.
And that's my big resolution for this year is to try to, you know, I got my sleep dialed in. I got my weight loss. I got my exercise. I'm adding meditation. But I just want to take those four fundamentals and increase them as part of my New Year's resolution. Maybe lose the at last, like maybe 10 pounds, get to 165. And the weight training going, really dial in the sleep, get that 80-90 sleep score every night, not just four or five nights a week. So try to get that to six nights a week, maybe. Yeah, and then the diet, I'm really doing well with that, but I got to take out a little of the sugar. So anyway, those are my resolutions. You got any short, quick hits on your New Year resolutions? New Year's resolutions.
So abs, for sure. I'm putting in a lot of push-ups, Jason. I'm not going to lie. A lot of planking, a lot of crunches, trying to work on that. I avoided new dad weight round two, thankfully, because I gained like 15 the first time, and it was brutal. Abs, finish a novel, don't drink for a year. And I think I'm going to add a non-professional, really personal one. I want to be a really great husband and father this year. I want to be patient. I want to be kind. I want to be engaged and available. And I want to be a little bit less in my head. So a little bit more stoic, a little more zen, a little bit less frenetic, a little bit less all the time. So
I think, you know, you have an active mind is my perception. And when you have an active mind, you're highly intelligent, which you are both of those things. You can have a hard time turning it off. There's a very simple way to do this. Mm. Just get the Calm app. I'm talking my own book here, but I invested in that company for a reason. And they have 1 minute, 3 minute, 5 minute, 10 minute. Just do it 10 days in a row.
Yeah.
1, 3, 4, 5, whatever number of minutes, a breathing exercise, some music that they have at a specific hertz that helps you go to sleep. Just do that. Then go interact with your kids. That's my secret. And there are other like stoic tests you can do to help you frame. And shout out to the guy, is it Ryan Holiday?
Ryan Holiday.
Shout out to Ryan Holiday, who I have to catch up with because, you know, we've crossed paths a couple of times. And he's also in Bastrop, which is east of Austin. And I would love to have dinner with him maybe one of these Thursday nights or go out to see him. Anyway, you know, doing that stoic exercise where you think about losing something or loss or not having it. Another framing is, if you were 70 years old, your kids are 30 years old, cat's in the cradle, you know, they're gone, they don't call you all that often, they're busy with their lives. If you could go back to this moment in time, I may get a little emotional here, but if you go back to this moment in time, what would you pay for that? What would the value of that be when you're 75 years old to go back to the moment when they're 3.5 years old, they're screaming, they're inconsolable, you've got a diaper, while you're changing the diaper, another thing happens, they puke on you, you're covered in puke, you're cleaning a diaper, it's 2 a.m., you got an insufferable boss who's like, where's the Twist 500?
Man, were you at my house last night? Because we had one of those nights.
And it's trying. It is trying, right? And so that's what I do. And when I was on this vacation, I was saying to myself, I don't get this back. I don't get this moment with the whole family. I got the whole family out one day, five at the same time going down the same ski run.
I saw your picture of that. It looks really cute.
And I just have to tell you, like, I just looked at that and I said, I'm making memories.
Yes.
Making memories for them, for myself, for all eternity. And so use those techniques. And I think you'll, you know, with a little meditation, a little equanimity, and a little stoicism, you can get through what is the chaotic days. I always loved Warren Zevon, Werewolves of London, Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Ton of great songs. He was on David Letterman. He had found out he was dying of lung cancer.
Ooh, okay.
He had never been to a doctor for 25 years. And David Letterman said to him, hey, what can we learn from you that you've got this diagnosis and you've got a very short period of time now? He said, well, the first thing is go to the doctor more than once every 30 years. And they laugh. And then he said, well, what else can, you know, but in all seriousness, you know, aside from visiting a doctor, and he was a smoker, lung cancer, the whole thing. He said, what can you tell us? He said, well, you know, enjoy every sandwich. Enjoy every sandwich. And if I ever got a tattoo, it would be of one or two things. Enjoy every sandwich and a picture of a sandwich or a bulldog. And in my weird 54-year-old, you know, I don't know, three-quarter life crisis, if I ever have one, I might do that. I might get a sandwich on my arm or something with just those enjoy every sandwich, EES, enjoy every sandwich, because it is such a powerful concept, the simplicity of a sandwich, and just enjoying every bite. That is my message for all of you in hope for a great 2025. No one likes dealing with taxes, especially a busy startup. Did you know you're required to pay digital sales tax wherever your customers are? That's where Paddle steps in to put your billing on autopilot. When you launch your SaaS product, an app, or a game, you're building something that can reach billions globally. That's the magic of the internet, of app stores, and it's awesome. But scaling brings a lot of challenges, like taking payments in local currencies and navigating all those regional tax laws. Plus, managing fraud and refunds, that's a tremendous headache that will slow you down. Maintaining a messy payment stack eats up time, energy, and money. And these big company problems compound with every new market you enter. Paddle has seen these challenges 1,000 times or more. As you're a merchant of record, you're more, M-O-R, they're going to handle payment localization, fraud prevention, tax compliance, and customer billing support so that you can grow faster. You need to launch in a new country? You're done. You need to set local pricing? One click. You want to add payment methods? Easy peasy, lemon squeezy. So here's your call to action. Wherever you want to take your business, go there with Paddle. Go to paddle.com/twist to get started with your exclusive fee-free period. That's paddle.com/twist to unlock your no-fee starter period.
Yeah, and thank you everyone for being here to kick it off with us at Twist. Jason is still in front of a tree. He has his fire going. I still have my accoutrement up to indicate my own holiday enjoyment. But Jason, why don't we give the people what they want? And I believe that is spelled C-H-A-R-T. In Twist terminology. So let's grab one.
Love a good chart.
Yeah. And let's start with this. So this is actually a chart that you tweeted. And I wanted to start here because I thought it was a fascinating chart. But I'm curious, why is this, quote, something that you think a lot about? And why did you share it to start the year?
Well, you know, when I started in venture capital, there were very few players. Very few. 30 years ago. There were 20, 30 years ago, very few players. You had your Sequoia, you had your Kleiner, you know, some other weird firms. It was a very bespoke, weird, unique, tiny business.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Google happened. And you had this sort of big company that nobody had ever seen before. And obviously Apple, when Steve Jobs came back and the iPhone happened, those two things created an industry that was larger than people could ever imagine. And in the early days, people used to go public with $25 million, $50 million in revenue. So a lot of the growth that happened was after the IPO, people would hand them off. And what this chart is showing is Instacart's delivery, Instacart's major investors, and the price of each funding round. You see here, Kosla, Canon Partners, and Y Combinator paid 24 cents. I'm assuming that's the share price.
Yeah.
And then Sequoia paid 24 cents. So what happened there is, even though that was a year apart, the seed and the Series A, the seed round was on a convertible note that converted, I guess, without a discount to that Series A round, which is weird that they didn't have a discount on it. But okay, so those two people did the earliest investments and they paid 24 cents a share. Andreessen Horowitz came in for the Series B a year later and paid $3 a share. And then you had Kleiner and some other folks come in for the Series C at 2015. And you see this nice, like every year, Sequoia, Y Combinator come in at $18. Now they had paid 24 cents. Now they're paying $18, right? Almost like 100x what they paid originally, maybe 75x or something like that, 5 years later. In other words, they had inside information. This was a great company. So they both made a second bet. That's when Y Combinator had their fund, which was their
growth fund.
Continuity, right.
Continuity
growth.
Fund, yeah.
They came up with the term continuity for it. Weird name, terrible name, actually, because it gives the impression that it's not as cutthroat as it is and that everybody gets one, which I think is why Gary probably got rid of it.
Yes.
And then you start to see other folks come in like Tiger Global, D1 Capital, DST, which is Yuri Milner's famous firm, General Catalyst, one of the mega ones. And then eventually this last round where Fidelity, T. Rowe, Andreessen, and Sequoia paid $125 a share in 2021, peak ZIRP.
Peak ZIRP.
And somebody took these and they circled, you know, the Series D and called it venture capital. And then they called the Series E and above not venture capital. You and I had talked about this last week, I think.
Yes.
And I just want to point out to people that when we talk about venture, there's, I think, trad VC, and then I think there's new VC.
Yes.
And for founders, it's really important to understand where you are in this journey. Trad VC, traditional venture capital, we're placing bets, we're helping you grow the product, find product market fit. And then whatever this new VC is, this late stage new VC, what I'll just call, I don't know, the growth stage.
Sure.
Pre-IPO, Mez. I'm going to just call it Mez financing. Screw it. I'm going old school. Trad VC and Mez, because we used to call this mezzanine financing, mm-hmm. like this little round between when you were venture and private and going public. So I'm going to say this is Mez growth.
Yeah.
A Trad VC is like the bespoke art, punk rock, gut feeling, roll up your sleeves. Yes. And everything else is just a spreadsheet. It's just people with a spreadsheet. And I'm not diminishing them, but the decisions made there are made largely on some economic bet. And that bet did not pay off because the public markets did not reward the private market investors after a certain round. And that's what the chart shows. So if we throw up that chart one more time, at what point, and what is the stock price today?
Yep.
If we look at Instacart, you know, at what point were you underwater with your investment? Because here, I think it's somewhere, you know, it IPO'd at $27, which means, you know, that Series E, the first non-venture capital, the Mez financing, mm-hmm. is still underwater by a third almost.
So the share price today, because I thought this is where we'd go with this, was about $44 when I checked it a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. So actually, I think D1 Capital with the tender offer in 2020 is probably only now underwater by just a little bit. But that means
they're at break even, yeah.
But that means everything after, which was the bulk of the capital probably invested in the firm because late stage rounds are larger than early stage rounds, didn't do well. And I think this just goes to show that venture capital, the model, the 2-in-20 model, the partner model, the everything we know about venture capital doesn't always scale perfectly through the Mez tranches. But the reason why I like Mez, Jason, mezzanine, as an idea here is it was always supposed to be temporary and short and constrained. A mezzanine is not the entire venue, right?
No, it's just this little, balcony, right? This little mezzanine, the balcony there. So, you know, the point here is those people put their money in, they sat around for 4 or 5 years and had no return. In that same time, if they had just bought the S&P, mm-hmm. et cetera, you know, there were 10 to 25% returns each of those years. In other words, they would have tripled their money, double tripled their money if they just put it in an index fund. So the industry has changed radically. And the industry in some ways has been broken. Part of it is too much capital mm-hmm. and trying to make it bigger than it is. And that's why, just making the announcement here today, I am committing our firm to going even earlier. I have decided, you know, as over the break here, I want our firm Launch, mm-hmm. which does Founder University, a pre-accelerator where half the companies aren't even incorporated yet.
Yep.
And the accelerator, which is a peer to Techstars, and Y Combinator, where we, you know, have companies that have modest traction or they're, you know, MVPs just going into the market.
Yeah.
We're going to really focus 95% of our effort there. And we were spending about a third, third in directs, third in accelerator, third in pre-accelerator. I'm just looking at it saying, you know what, we can do our most work, the best use of our time is in Founder Universe and Accelerator. So I'm kind of reorganizing our firm around this concept. And so I'm announcing that our Founder University 10th cohort is going to be in person in Austin. So if you're interested in hanging out with me every Tuesday, because Thursdays I tape all in, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I do the Swing Startups. Tuesday is going to be my Founder University day. I'm going to make Tuesday my day for just hanging out with the Founder University Accelerator companies. And we're going to do it in person. I don't know how exactly that will come together. I may get a co-working space. I may do it with my friends at Capital Factory. But I've been looking at that chart, thinking about it a whole bunch, and thinking about where I want to spend the remaining years I have to be productive. All right, founders, let's talk about your fitness. Yes, you can't build the next Google. You're not going to build the next Uber if you're not taking care of yourself. And this includes exercise. That's why I want you to check out Fitbod. Fitbod is like having your own personal trainer right in your pocket. I use it. I love it. It designs workouts tailored to you and your goals, as well as the equipment available to you. And of course, your fitness level. So if you're just starting out or you're already crushing it at the gym, Fitbod helps you level up your fitness. How does it work? It's pretty simple. They use machine learning, they use exercise science, and they build you a custom workout plan that's just for you. And it's based on things like the muscle fatigue of your past workouts and your recovery. So listen, you don't wind up like doing too many quads and not enough abs and too much back. It monitors all that for you. It tracks things like muscle fatigue and recovery, so you avoid overworking or underworking any muscle group. And if you don't have a gym, that's not a problem. Fitbod works anywhere, and it keeps your workouts fresh and effective. So for example, when I'm on the road, I might go to one of those hotels that has like a tiny little claustrophobic gym, and all they have is like dumbbells and a treadmill. No problem. Easy peasy. You tell Fitbod what is available, it makes your workout. Now, I might be at a full gym where they have a circuit, where they got kettlebells, which I love, and then it will give me a workout based on the kettlebells and the circuit machines. And what's really interesting is I use the Watch app, and I can just sit there, doot, 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 and log my sets in the workout app. I can change them. There's a little key where like you still want to get biceps, but there's three or four different ways to get biceps worked out. You can pick the one you want to do. They have over 1,400 videos to guide you through every move in Fitbod, and you can kick off 2025 nice and strong. Take all the guesswork out by getting 25% off your Fitbod subscription, or you can just try it for free. Fitbod.me/twist. That's FITBOD.ME/twist. Fitbod, personalized fitness that grows with you.
Well, let's talk about the idea of going earlier, because one thing that people have been talking about lately is how venture capital fundraising on the venture side has become very concentrated amongst a couple of firms. So just to give people some background around why you might be going early, here is a chart that shows just the number of venture capital firms that are active, just as a little bit of background for folks. This, by the way, Jason, is via the Financial Times and PitchBook data, and it just goes to show that, as you can see over time, more firms and then fewer firms. And why that matters is we have seen the amount of venture capital raised go down, but also become more concentrated. So if you look at this chart here from PitchBook, this is from December, so it's slightly out of date, but it's mostly correct. We can see that a handful of firms have raised the bulk of the capital. And if we're going to think about the example of Instacart that we started with, I presume that they're going to deploy a lot of that capital into later stage rounds, because you cannot deploy billions of dollars each year into a pre-accelerator, Jason. I mean, what are the checks for Founder University?
I'll get right to that. But looking at this strip chart here, $49 billion raised by the top 30 firms. Andreessen, $7 billion, General Catalyst, $6 billion, Thrive Capital, Josh Kushner's, shout out to Josh, $5.5 billion. These people are doing mezzanine financing. When you're putting $1 billion or $2 billion into, you know, taking Twitter private, or, you know, ChatGPT at $150 billion, like, should ChatGPT not be a public company if they're making $6 billion a year? Like, what are we talking about here? Why are these companies private? Now, I know they have a special situation because they're trying to do this fugazi nonprofit into a for-profit thing. But then you look, you know, the other experienced managers and emerging managers are a small portion of that. I think LPs need to start thinking about, well, where do they want to concentrate their dollars and what is the best use of their capital and time? If they want to have average returns, I think these late stage funds are a great way to get exposure. And it's, I think what's happening in their minds, I'm going to do a little mind reading here, is I think they're going to look eventually at this mezz financing cohort, you know, what Josh is doing at Thrive. And again, this is not a criticism, as public market investing. They're public market investing.
So then, Jason, just to be clear, that means they're going to be shooting for essentially the S&P. They're going to be—
If they beat 7%, 12%, they're better than the S&P on average, as you know, as a lover of low fee index funds.
It's true.
And then the rest of us are trying to hit double or triple that, 15 or 21%, let's say, so that we say, hey, you know, these things are private. Anyway, I think for founders who are looking at this, just understand, you know, if you're going to a firm that has, you know, 5, 10, 20 billion under management, they just are not going to give the attention to you as a tiny founder trying to figure it out. So I think, just as founders, be thoughtful and put your expectation. You know, listen, if you're going to talk to Josh Kushner or Andreessen Horowitz, the late stage group there, they're putting $1 billion or $5 billion or $2 billion into some of these deals. If they're putting $250K into your deal, it's not going to move the needle for them. It's not going to get their attention. That doesn't mean they're bad people. It's just the nature of it. Just like I can't help you when you're raising at, you know, $1 billion or $100 million even when you need $30 million or $40 million. I can refer you to my friends, but that's almost the entire size of my fund. We do a $45 million fund. The good news for me is I don't need a lot of capital. I want to do 200 of these 25K checks for Founder University. It's your original question. We give people their first 25K check to start their company, and then we give them a 125K check, just like the same terms as Y Combinator and Techstars when they're in that second stage. So I think ideally, I would like to do 200 of the 25K checks. You know, that's about 5 million, and then do another 5 million in the 125K checks, which is about, I guess, 40 of those, right? So, you know, that would be 240 companies a year, which would be 2.5 times what we're doing now. We're about at 100 a year now. That means I only really need 10 million a year to deploy, 15 million a year. And I can have enough surface area that if we hit a unicorn every 200, we could have a really amazing fund, you know, just doing the math on paper. So I've been thinking a lot about this. The market keeps changing. My original thought was I would keep half our money in reserves to bet on the biggest winners. But what I'm realizing is, gosh, a lot of these seed funds are, a lot of these seed rounds, when these big funds dip into them, they're demanding 10% ownership, which means they want to put in $10 million, which means they ratchet a seed round up to $100 million. And the company's got $100 million valuation. They have $1 million in revenue, so they give them 100x. And that's just going to like distort reality, as we've seen. Instacart's reality got distorted there. And these distortion effects can be profound and problematic. We're going to talk about it in the back half of the show, because Bench and Level, two promising firms, just busted out. We'll get into that in detail. You know, I want to get into immigration. Thank you for like bringing up this topic and following my Twitter stream, because it is, you know, big on my mind. And I know people like to know what I'm thinking, and I like to share what I'm thinking. Why do I like to share what I'm thinking, Alex? People email me, jason@calacanis.com is my email for life, or they DM me and tell me that I'm a horrible person and, you know,
Dude, you got to lock down your DMs,
I love it. Locking my DMs. I love the savage DMs I get. It's incredible.
Okay.
You don't like them.
I tweet them out in collections. I'm just like, I can only take so much. I think I have a slightly lower bar for negativity day to day than you do. I just like, after the third or fourth time someone calls me something nasty, I'm just like, all right, that's enough for today.
It's strictly a reflection on how they're feeling about themselves at that moment.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
Strictly, and usually it's a troubled person or a 12-year-old or a Russian Chinese bot trying to cause trouble or just somebody doing engagement farming in order to make money, you know?
Jason, you asked us to put together a couple of stats to help frame the debate that we've had nationally, I want to say, about high school immigration. And we have a guest in just a second that's an expert. But I want to show this little infographic because I think it provides some good foundational information for everyone who's watching today. So this is a couple of data points. One, how many new H-1B visas were granted? And the latest full year data we have is from 2023. Everybody will have 2024 data very soon, but we wanted to be consistent. So the number was 118,948, and that's a little bit above the cap number everyone talks about, and that's because there are some exempt categories. The total number of illegal immigrants in the U.S. in 2023, we went through a bunch of different data points. The best number we could find was about 11.7 million total. And then the unemployment rate for the U.S. back in 2023, 3.6%. And as of right now, open tech jobs, the best number we could find that was inclusive was about 530,000 tech jobs. So, Jason, that's what you wanted to know. And I hope that that is accurate to current data, too.
Well, we will put these in the notes. We'll cite our sources always. Yes. And you know, the illegal immigration number is hard to pin down because it's an estimate. And they have this thing like encounters at the border. Yes. And I don't know if that 11.7 million is the cumulative during the Biden-Kamala Harris administration or it's in the single year. I think that's like the combined.
That's expected total illegal immigrants living in the U.S.
In the U.S.
It went down to 10 and has now picked back up, and we're approaching 12 million again, but we're still under the all-time national peak, which was 2008.
Okay, everybody, 2025 is here. With every startup hitting the ground running, it's time for you to be competitive and to beat those competitors in B2B selling. So if your ad strategy doesn't include relentless focus on targeting the right prospects, well, listen, your message might get lost in the noise. Well, LinkedIn ads is going to ensure that you reach the right audience at the right time in the right place. LinkedIn's advertising tools connect you to decision makers based on their job title, their industry, and the company size, and many other factors. So maybe you're targeting your beachhead market, your ideal customer profile, the one most likely to buy your product, is a company between 50 and 250 employees. Maybe it's companies between 1,000 and 5,000. You can target just the people you want to reach and just the titles you want to reach using LinkedIn ads. LinkedIn has the two things that you need to grow this year: reach and impact. On the reach side, LinkedIn has more than a billion members, 130 million of them are decision makers, and 10 million of them are C-level executives, the people who are the hardest to get in front of. Hey, listen, I'm one of them, and I'm on LinkedIn every day, multiple times a day. On the impact front, B2B marketers report 2 to 5 times higher return on ad spend compared to other social platforms. Plus, 79% of B2B marketers say LinkedIn is the best platform for paid media. LinkedIn ads allows you to build the right relationships, drive results, and reach your customers in a respectful environment. I mean, it's really about business. When I say business, you think LinkedIn. When I say LinkedIn, you think business. That's why you want to put your B2B message there. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/thisweekinstartups to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/thisweekinstartups. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. And let me just say here, because I have a lot of friends who are involved in the administration, I don't have to say who they are. You can just
Google
look
them.
You can just Google them, look at my Twitter stream. and people are weaponizing what I say against my friends.
I
don't know if you've seen this, but a lot of the fringe elements of MAGA and some other things are just taking whatever I say and then slamming it into my friends' feeds and saying, hey, your bestie, your best friend, your good friend, your colleague, your business partner. They don't even know the nature of my relationships. They're saying this with people who maybe I don't even have a relationship with or have a very cursory relationship. I am going to be very muted for the next couple of weeks about these issues on my social and here because I don't like to get my friends dragged for my comments.
Okay.
So if people think I'm being a little subdued, I am self-censoring myself by choice. I don't have to. Nobody's asked me to. But I'm going to self-censor myself a bit over the coming weeks just so I don't get weaponized. But the H-1B visa discussion, you wanted to talk about on the show. You're the co-host. We had a guest booked. I want to talk about it here from maybe less of a political basis, but more of an educational basis.
Absolutely.
Just to level set facts.
This is Lisa Wedden, founder CEO of Plymouth Street. Jason, she worked for Bloomberg Beta back in the day. She's a Sequoia scout as well. So she's been on the venture side and the founder side. And I booked her because I had the same thought, H-1B visas. And then as I was learning so much more about the U.S. immigration system this week, it turns out that her firm mostly works with O-1 visas, which are different than H-1B visas. So one, Lisa, thank you for being here. How are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm great.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. So I want to start at a kind of a high level here and talk about the impact of immigrants on the technology scene. The American Immigration Council says that 44.8% of the Fortune 500 companies back in 2003 were founded by immigrants or their children. I know this is a near and dear issue to your heart. So I'm curious, when you think about high school immigration, what is your compelling argument you tell people who are skeptical as to why it matters to our national growth?
So I think the stats are really compelling here. 55% of technology unicorns are founded by immigrants. Some of the most iconic companies of our generation, SpaceX, Replit, Stripe, have all been founded by immigrants. And when you think about, you know, the early discussion, capital is not necessarily the constraint for innovation. Human talent is. Plymouth's mission when we set up was to accelerate U.S. innovation by enabling the highest skilled talent to build in America. And immigrants have consistently proven time and time again to be some of the most innovative, risk-taking, entrepreneurial individuals.
And absolutely.
So that's the core focus here is how do we unlock a new era of U.S. innovation?
So my question then is, why is your firm so focused on O-1 visas as opposed to the much more, I would say, newsy recently H-1B program that I think people are much more familiar with than the O-1 program?
Totally. So the H-1B program was designed in the 1990s, and it was set up with a 65,000 cap limit. Today, over 780,000 individuals apply for the H-1B. And the reality is that we could be losing out, and I think we are losing out on the world's best talent, because these individuals are put into a lottery ticket system. And so you could imagine a leader in AI, a leader in quantum, a leader in nuclear energy puts their name in a lottery ticket system and they don't get it. And I think the reality is that we want to recruit and retain this world-class talent. And in comparison to the H-1B, the O-1 is not a lottery ticket system. You have to put together a real research report about an individual. You know, these applications are between 400 to 600 pages long to document someone's extraordinary ability. And so you have to be really elite to get this visa pathway.
Okay. I just want to recap here, Alex. O-1 visas.
Yes.
This is, I think the quote is, I'm reading here, extraordinary ability or achievement in science, arts, education, business, or athletics. They must demonstrate sustained national, international acclaim and recognition in their field. This can be proven through awards, publications, high salary, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That is one one type of visa to come to the United States. And this is extremely rigorous. And there is no abuse here, or almost no abuse. In your mind, Lisa, it's too hard to game the O-1?
You know, less than 5,000 STEM individuals come into the US on an O-1 visa, and you have to document substantial evidence to prove the O-1 visa.
Okay.
It's not easy. No, it's not an easy pathway to game.
How many get awarded each year? And how many applications, just ballpark, if you know that number?
Just under 30,000 get awarded each year. And the majority of those visas actually go for O-1Bs, which is in the entertainment and the artistic professions.
So if there is less abuse of O-1 visas compared to the H-1B program, which I think everyone agrees has a place, could use some fixes, do you expect that technology companies writ large are going to move away from H-1B visas and toward the O-1 process simply because it's not a lottery and therefore is worth the extra effort to go through because it's not random, it's merit-based?
I think companies use every tool in their toolkit to retain their best talent. And different visa pathways offer this opportunity. You know, there's the TN category for Canadians and Mexicans. There are visa pathways for Australians. You know, the visa landscape is not a one-size-fits-all. I think also when you talk about early-stage startups and later-stage companies, they have different talent needs. I think the O-1 is an amazing visa pathway for the very best talent, both at the earliest stages for founders who want to build in America and the later stages. And I think the best companies that we work with, like Midjourney, Replit, Pika AI, they take their talent extremely seriously because they know that the constraint for growth is finding the very best talent.
I'm just curious about the viability of O-1 visas to hopefully expand to allow for more high school immigration, because I think personally, just my own view, not even speaking for Jason or the show, that if we could 10x the number of very brilliant people that work in technology that can come here and stay every year, it would be worth, you know, at least 1% GDP growth per annum, which is the cheapest thing you could possibly buy. I'm just curious, does the O-1 program have the capacity to help with that? Or do we have to fix H-1Bs to get that level of high school immigration flowing?
So I think there's reform across the system, but the O-1 is an uncapped visa pathway and we should be utilizing it. And this administration should utilize it insofar as it achieves our goal of American competitiveness. I think the message for the world should be America is open for business, for the world's best skilled innovators, and we want you to come and build here and innovate in this economy. And I think this is a golden opportunity to share that message and utilize every tool in our toolkit to do that. And visas are a component of that.
All right. And then I just want to get your take on this, because I know you're a bigger fan of the O-1 visa than the H-1B, but the H-1B has been criticized just a lot lately. It's lost some of its, I'd say, public luster. How fair do you think the criticisms are of H-1B visas, that they underpay or they entrap workers into contracts they can't get out of because they get deported? How reasonable are the criticisms of H-1Bs in your view?
I think there are, you know, most practitioners would say that these are known issues that we need to identify and reform. I think there's been a ton of really interesting discussion online around increasing the compliance fees for companies, you know, increasing the wage requirements. You know, this program was designed in the 1990s. Again, we want a system that is adaptable and updates to our modern era. And so, you know, I think there is reasonable criticism that most practitioners have known.
I can give a little color on that, actually.
Sure.
Alex, when I was in the start of my career in the IT business, I was at Sony. Statute of limitations is over. or I don't really care. I'll just say it. I was out to lunch with the people running the IT department. And they said, hey, we don't have to work weekends anymore. We got these Indian guys. And they're going to be, you know, in this office somewhere in the middle of America. And they're dirt cheap. They get paid 50% less than us. And they come here with their family. If they don't do what we tell them, and they don't work the hours we tell them, we can deport them. And they have 30 days to find a new job, which they can't. So therefore, they're going to do all the weekend shifts. They're going to work 50, 60 hours a week. There's nothing they can say. And I said, wow, that's really dark. And they said, yeah, it's great. And I was just a 21-year-old kid. And I was like, yeah, but that makes them kind of like indentured servants. It's totally abhorrent. And all the discussions I heard about H-1B specifically during that time period, in the IT business specifically, not entrepreneurial pursuits, was just about saving money and maybe being able to grind these employees down. Is there a fair criticism to that and what I experienced 30 years ago?
You know, I can't speak on behalf of all H-1B holders, but I can speak to the people that I talk to every day. A large number on H-1Bs, and they want more flexibility to be able to work at different companies, start their own companies. You know, there's these incredible H-1B employees who are working at large tech organizations, and they want to move onto another visa pathway because they want to build in America. And they are, you know, struggling with this visa category that they're pursuing because they do have to maintain their status, maintain their prevailing wage. And so from my kind of own personal perspective, like, I am hearing stories of individuals who want to move off the H-1B because it is not the right visa category for them. And there are, you know, there are companies that abuse the H-1B category too. We know this. Like, there are.
How do you solve the abuse? How would you solve the abuse? I've watched the Twitter debates. I have my own answers, but I'm curious from your perspective, if you could wave your magic wand, you do this for a living, you work on these, three things would you change in order to make it more fair to American workers who want those jobs and to the employees who, I believe, in some cases, might be 5% or 10%. It's obviously not the majority. Maybe, you know, it's unfair to them.
Yeah, you know, I focus most of my work not on H-1B visas. Like, I look to people who are moving off H-1B visa. But I think the reality is like, there are, you know, several things that are interesting about reforming the H-1B. One is that you could look to explore to increase the costs for companies for the H-1B. So increasing the annual compliance costs for H-1B visa, that would be, I think, really interesting. Increasing certain elements of the wage requirements could be really interesting, and reforming the number of allocations in the lottery for companies. And I think those would be, frankly, kind of like an interesting and necessary requirement for ensuring that this visa category is updated from the 90s.
Awesome.
You know, if you go back to Twist episode 35, we had Brad Feld on and little baby Jason, you know, 14 years ago. They were talking about this issue. And one thing that they brought up was the idea of an entrepreneur or investor visa, Jason. The idea that if you're going to deliberately come here and start a company, there should be a separate door just for you.
There should be an easy way for a foreign entrepreneur who wants to start a business in the U.S.,
right,
that raises a certain amount of money from U.S. investors,
you're
to
in,
be able to get a visa and get going.
Right. Put that amount of money in a bank account, fill out a form, you're done.
That's right. So it turns out, as we start talking, you know, to the politics is a mystery to me, but to my, you know, the friends of mine that are in the House and the Senate and some of the other people that we know, what we found out pretty quickly was there's a type of visa called an EB-5 visa, which is basically the opposite of what we want. The EB-5 visa, which has been around since 1990, gives a visa to a foreigner who invests $1 million in a U.S. company.
Oh, genius.
Right? So you can basically are, you know, the idea is to drive investment in U.S. companies,
right.
But the person getting the visa is simply the investor. So, you know, there's a lot of controversy around that particular type of visa, people buying visas, et cetera, but the structure was parallel. We want the opposite. We want the U.S. to be the investor, and we want the entrepreneur to be
this
somebody.
This is the talent.
Exactly.
If you have Yao Ming in China, you want him to play in the NBA.
Exactly.
So somehow his visa got approved.
That's right. That's right.
And Lisa, just as a last thought, do you think we need, instead of trying to fix and shoehorn our needs into the O-1 and H-1B categories, just simply a blank sheet of paper and an entirely new category or new system to avoid just endless rounds of small technocratic fixes to a program that seems to have larger issues?
I think there's huge opportunities to explore like a fast track entrepreneur visa. They did actually come out with the international entrepreneurship rule, which was a different opportunity, but it was very complicated and not super fit for purpose. And so, yeah, to the extent that we can streamline this immigration system and have very clear opportunities for innovators, I'm so in favor of it. In this moment, we do have visa categories that are advantageous for entrepreneurs, so we're doubling down on that. But again, you know, let's be innovative and let's think about our ultimate goal, which is advancing US innovation. And to the extent that we can think through every tool in our toolkit, I'd advocate for that.
All right, Lisa, thank you so much. PlymouthStreet.com if you want to look up her work. Thank you much. And we'll
what do you charge, Lisa? How much does it cost if a company hires you per person? How do you get paid?
We get paid per visa. So
how much? What does it cost?
Between $10,000 to $12,000.
Oh, okay. So it's kind of reasonable, but it's not cheap.
It's your very best talent. We really fundamentally believe in investing in your talent. And these applications are over 500 pages long. So we really focus on ensuring that you can consistently and reliably bring over your best talent.
Fantastic. Really appreciate you coming on, Lisa.
Thanks so much.
Thank you much.
Appreciate it.
You know, it was great to have her on. I think there's a really easy way to solve this problem.
Hit me.
Number one, a minimum salary.
Yes.
I don't know if it's 50, 60, or 70K, but that's an easy one to do. You put in a minimum salary for this. Number two, you have 1 year to find a new job. So if you're on an H-1B visa, you have a year to find a new job. Now, I know what people are going to say, you know, like, that's unfair or whatever, but hear me out because here's the next piece. When I am an employer, I pay 10% of your salary. 10% of your salary, not just $1,000 or whatever these application fees are, 10% of your salary up to a certain number. So there's like a minimum, but it also maxes out so that you have a disincentive for trying to use this for, like, let's say frontline IT PC support specialists, you know, somebody who comes and reformats your hard drive or reinstalls software, your whatever's not working. And I think a lot of this stems from the fact that a lot of people on the GI Bill or, you know, folks thought, hey, I can get a degree from some degree mill. They sold me on being an IT person. They told me the starting salary in IT was 75K. So I went 30, 40K into debt. I figured I could pay that back after the 5 or 10 years, you know, and then I would be making six figures eventually. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a second, the job I was going against, there's somebody getting paid 50K instead of 75K. Well, if you charge a minimum of 10K per year and you force people to pay not only the 10K, but the employer has to pay the 10K the second year when you leave.
Oh, so if you go away, they're still on the hook for it.
Still on the hook for that year. Or maybe you're on the hook for 6 months and the new employer's on the hook for the next one. Whatever it is.
Sure.
There's some sort of fee. So that if you are an employer, you really have to think about this. Then you take all that money. Uh-huh. And I think Aaron Levy, friend of the pod, has been on many times, from Box, said, hey, why don't you put that money towards STEM education? Hey, there you go. Now we're talking. Or maybe you put that money towards the people who had IT degrees from those paper mills. We identify them and we have a way for those folks to pay down the debt for IT degrees that maybe were overpriced or whatever. And I'm not big into that because I like people to make that decision, but I'm just thinking creatively here because there is valid criticism here. I believe there's significant abuse on the low end.
Yeah.
And once you eliminate that, I think people are going to have a much easier time with this issue.
I think so too. I don't think we're ever going to get the people who want to shut down all immigration for all time in the United States ever on our side here. But if there's a way we could grab 65% of the population and open up the economy to allow for more smart people to come here and build and have faster GDP growth and have more of a talent edge on the rest of the world by being an attractive place for brains to drain to, well, then we'd have a stronger nation, more money, and happier people, Jason. And I'm just so in favor of that. I want big America, strong America.
I have literally three blog posts I drafted that I'm holding until after Trump's in office and this all dies down, because I don't want to poke the tiger here and have people taking my blog post, quoting it, because I have different feelings on this. And you can look at my Twitter. I've said, I think we should be the most prosperous and the most populous country. I think both of those things are important. And how do you get there? You're going to get there through population growth and people having babies, and you're going to get there through immigration. But you know what? We got plenty of time to talk about this in 2025.
We do. And we have plenty of time after the administration has all gone through confirmations. So now, moving on. Sad news, but I want to talk about this. So rewinding the clock a little bit, Bench fell apart at the end of last year. At the end of 2024, Bench, a company that people had heard of and used for a long time, that had last raised money back in 2021, Jason, and was
outsourced accounting firm, right?
Outsourced accounting firm, exactly.
And Loved by startups.
And when they died, it shocked people, because I don't think people knew that they were on the ropes. And then to start the year, there's another company that's followed. It's a fintech HR startup called Level. It offered benefits. So essentially, if you were an employer, a startup, say, you could create kind of an innovative benefit program for your employees. They did self-insured dental and vision products. And you could also do wellness, fitness, all sorts of things using this Level program. They have also died. And according to Jason, the CEO, Paul Aaron, in an internal email that the information got, he said, quote, "While fundraising, we entered an acquisition process that we believed would provide significant value to our clients and members. Unfortunately, the deal fell through at the last minute due to external challenges beyond our control." My question to you, because I have a lot of thoughts about the business and the timing and so forth, but when a CEO says we were fundraising, there was an acquisition, and it fell apart, what does that tell you in your spidey sense?
It tells me the company was burning too much capital.
Okay.
The investors had lost faith in this company being a great place to deploy capital. So they're burning too much money. Maybe the actual unit economics didn't work. So new investors assessing this opportunity might have thought, if they're burning some millions of dollars a month at this company, the valuation is very high. There's all these covenants and all of this preference stack where the latest investors get 2x. If I come in and I do a pay-to-play round or a cram-down round where I say all the existing investors, their shares are going to get diluted 100 to 1 or 50 to 1 or 25 to 1 or 10 to 1 or 5 to 1, they're going to be common shares, and then we're going to start over, raise more money. They just thought, you know, that pain and suffering, as Bill Gurley has said over and over again, I've heard him say this on many podcasts, a lot of investors are just like, I don't want to come into a toxic situation and be the toxic person who delivers the medicine to the patient. And maybe acquirers, because of the wrath of Lena Khan, looked at it and said, I can't acquire this for some reason, or they just weren't acquisitive. And or the unit economics of doing outsourced bookkeeping just looked like this was a bookkeeping firm that didn't really have enough technology there, and the mission to use technology to make bookkeeping, you know, auto-categorize expenses and costs. Maybe that just never got there. So maybe it wasn't great execution, or maybe they just couldn't get the margin there and this experiment failed. And the board seems to have made two mistakes. One, they ousted the founder.
Yes.
There's been a big controversy, trying to out the board. Now, I would be very careful. The board might have been doing something fiduciary that was responsible as a fiduciary. If that CEO, and we don't know, was not hitting their numbers, was not a great leader, couldn't track talent, we don't know, then they probably were right to try to find a new leader, and maybe they found the wrong one. Or maybe it just, like I said, was a crack foundation or a failed experiment. So we don't have full information. You know, trying to out the VCs who ousted the founder, I'd be very careful.
That?
Yeah, I saw that. I would be very careful with that, because they might have actually been doing the right thing and the hard thing. And doing the hard right thing is hard, and it makes you look like a jerk as a VC. I've actually never ousted a founder. I've never, because I'm an early stage VC, we never got to that point. Yeah. But I, you know people who have, and sometimes it's like, this founder was off the rails. They were in founder mode. They were off in la-la land.
Well, that's why, to me, when a VC does actually pull a founder, I almost don't view it as a non-founder friendly move because it's done so infrequently, I presume, in only the most extreme of situations. So to me, if that happens, I actually judge the founder more than the VC. I want to go back to this bench thing. One last question, because I have been, well, not a question, more of a thing that I'm curious about. We have seen fewer deaths, fewer implosions, fewer big flameouts in the startup world of companies that raised a huge round at a big valuation in 2021 than I expected. But then we just had these two companies land in quick succession, bang, bang. And so the thing I'm curious about for this year is how many will we see in 2025? Will this be the year when companies that haven't raised since 21 fail? Because there's probably several thousand of them out there that are just waiting to either get bought for a dollar or to die. And maybe we're finally at that moment, Jason. Maybe it's here.
I think when you raise a ton of money and you have a lot of runway, you can kick the can down the road. You can do four riffs. You can raise your prices. But eventually, you know, you can put lipstick on the pig. You can paint the house. Mm-hmm. But it's still got a cracked foundation. It's still got a bad fundamentals, possibly. And I think that is the challenge. That is the challenge.
Well, we'll see. Do you want to wrap up with just a little bit on this Lyft Amazon?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that this was one of my big, the All In Prediction Show comes out tomorrow. My big business deal of 2025 in the prediction show, which you'll get today, Friday, was the, that there would be consolidation in the on-demand space and the autonomous space in 2025. Now, that's a bold prediction, but I do think we could see Amazon, Uber, DoorDash, BYD, Uber, Tesla, Zoox, Waymo. You're going to see some of these merge. If Waymo and Uber merged, they're de facto going to run the table on everybody. They become... It's going to be like a battle. It's going to be hard for Tesla to beat that, right?
No, I absolutely agree. Now, Uber plus Waymo equals win, I think.
I think they win. Uber plus Tesla means they win. Sure. So if you look at that, you have Waymo and Tesla plus Zoox, very promising, plus another 15 other providers of autonomy. So you take those 18 different autonomy providers. There's probably five that are the most credible. You take those five and you pair them with either Uber or DoorDash or Amazon and their deliveries, you got a pretty robust offering. And so with the end of the wrath of Lina Khan, we could see something epic occur. Something like the acquisition of Whole Foods or something like the acquisition, maybe even a better one, YouTube, Instagram, WhatsApp, like a mega matchup that has significant impact on the future.
So I agree with all of that, but I'm a recent convert to the Amazon possibility. And I had honestly forgotten
Why?
That Amazon owns Zoox.
Yeah, oh, you forgot. Got it. Zoox has got great potential.
It does. And so Amazon, if you forgot, like I did, Amazon bought Zoox back for $1.2, $1.3 billion in 2020. The company had raised up to... over about $1 billion, Jason, at a valuation that reached as high as $3.2 billion. So not the best venture exit, but certainly a property at Amazon that's done well. So lately, Zoox has expanded to San Francisco, larger Vegas footprint, and Foster City, and they're going to do their first public riders in Vegas this year. So Zoox officially is going to be a real robo-taxi company in the near future. So that means that they had the technology side, Jason, sorted out at Zoox, which is Amazon. And then there's Lyft, which my friend Anita Ramaswamy over at The Information pitched this Amazon Lyft deal as a 2025 option, which got everyone talking. And the thing that I'm just blown away by is how essentially Lyft is free. Lyft today is valued at exactly 1x its trailing revenue, whereas Uber is worth 3.25x and Tesla's worth 13.5x its trailing revenue. So you can buy Lyft for 1x revenue? Attach it to Zoox? That
sounds brilliant. You'd have to pay a premium
to
get the shareholders to give it up. And that premium would probably be 2x or 50% or 2x. So I think if you add a 50, 5% premium to it, but I think you're, and it is about to, you know, they are going to be break-even profitable. I don't know if they've got some funny gap uniqueness to Lyft. I haven't been tracking them, but
I can answer that for you. So yeah. They are roughly break-even-ish on a GAAP basis. They have $107 million of adjusted EBITDA in the last quarter. But the thing that I think is most important, Jason, is their trailing operating cash flow was $740 million in the last four quarters. So it's kicking off cash.
Awesome. So, you know, it's not... I mean, buying the number, you know, what will be the number 5, 6, 7, 8 most important player globally, maybe the 10th most important player globally, is not a power move. Power move is to buy Uber, Grab, DoorDash. Like, that's sure. The power move. And so Amazon tried to do restaurant delivery. They failed at that one. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they failed. I guess it's a hard problem to solve. They weren't focused on enough. Who knows what the reason was? But they like to take big risks. They bought Whole Foods. I think that took them a couple swings at bat, but I think that's actually working because I see Whole Foods coming to my house, and I know a lot of people are buying from Whole Foods via the Amazon interface now, and they seem to have figured that one out too. So I think, I don't think this is going to happen. I think I just think you're like buying a brand, you're going to disappear anyway, and Amazon already has the Prime members. So simply opening this up to Amazon Prime members and saying every Amazon Prime comes with essentially what Uber One is, and Uber One, Apple One, Amazon Prime, it's all the same thing. A membership fee to get people to use a product more, to increase consumption, and to do more lock-in. Uber One's got, I think, 20, 30 million members now. It's incredible. I just slowly picked up on it. And those people, from my understanding from public reports, spend a lot more money. So there's something really interesting about that Uber One membership and Amazon Prime that could be very powerful. If you think about those as one thing, and you think about what they're both doing, at their core, Amazon and Uber both move stuff.
Yes.
If I was on the board of Amazon, Tesla, or Google, I would have one thing in mind. And now people think I'm talking my book here. I have exposure to all these names except Tesla. And if I wanted to have a bunch of Tesla, I could. I think the stock's kind of hit meme territory right now. It's like a And I have owned Tesla in the past. The reason I don't own Tesla, as I said before on the show, is like people think I have some inside line because of my friendship with people over there. Just, I have exposure to everything. I'm not talking my book here. Whoever on those boards buys Uber, and I don't think Uber's for sale, but...
No, I don't think Dara's going to... Would it be
No, open, but well. if I was Bezos, I would get in a room with Dara and say, what do we got to do here? If I was Elon, if I was on the Tesla board, I would be like, because I think Tesla's now worth over $1 trillion. Uber's worth $130 billion or $40 billion. Giving up 10% of your equity or 5% of your equity to own those 25 million members and then just be guaranteed to win and to have a global footprint day one or day zero, because the cyber taxis aren't going to be on the road till next year sometime, or maybe the end of this year, and they'll go into mass production next year. To have that advantage, if Waymo gets that advantage, if I was Larry and Sergey, I would be going at Uber. I believe Uber merges or is acquired with one of the four players. Tesla, Amazon, Google, Waymo. And then, long shot of long shots, might get blocked, but a DoorDash and Uber combination.
Ah, that's scary.
Merger.
Even me, my ding, ding, ding antitrust bells go off at that one.
But I'll tell you why this is something that the antitrust people should at least maybe consider letting happen.
Okay.
Then you would have a company add to the Mag8 or Uber plus Airbnb. So expanding the Mag8 makes each member of the Mag8 less powerful.
Yeah.
We should be trying to take the Mag7 or 8 and make it into a Mag17 or 18.
Yeah, Mag 20. Yeah.
Make a Mag 20. Then that's the way, because you're not going to stop them. They're just too good at what they do. They're at the top of their game. They have too much cash. No administration can stop them. You're not going to break them up. Even if you do break them up, they're going to add more businesses. And so, or if you break up, if you force Google to spin out YouTube or something, you would actually then create a Mag 9. So there might be a case to break up one or two along the margins. That's my best belief here. But I do think we will see, we're going to go from 1% of rides globally being ride sharing to 20. In that case, The TAM's going 20x in the next decade or two, easily, in my mind. And if that's the case, then car ownership goes away. Man, Tesla's flat year over year, I think, on car deliveries, 1.8 million or something like that, which
is
extraordinary. It was
1% down year over year.
So even.
Yeah, but you call it even.
Car ownership is having an issue right now. I think young people don't want to own cars. So actually, Tesla's making the absolute right bet on the cyber taxi. So why not insure the win for 10% of your shares by buying Uber? For me, that would be like a dream. Or Amazon buying it, or DoorDashing.
A couple of data points here, just to wrap up this conversation. Lyft valuation as of right now, $6.03 billion. DoorDash, $72.5 billion. I think people don't realize how much more valuable DoorDash is than Lyft. Uber, $137 billion. And then we get into the big boys, Tesla, $1.27 trillion. And then Amazon, $2.35 trillion. And I'll just throw in Alphabet for good measure here. That is, drumroll please, $2.36 trillion. So there's a lot of capital here. Someone buy Uber to make Jason's month. And we're back on, we're doing a late show on Sunday.
Well, we're going to record the Monday show on Sunday. We might go live with it. We'll see. So if you're around Sunday night, because I'm going to be traveling on Monday, we're going to record the show Sunday. Back to, hey, listen, no rest. We like to, we love doing the show. We do whatever we have to do to get it. No rest for the weary. All right, everybody, do me a favor. Founder.university, start a company at 25. Number two, follow x.com/Alex, x.com/TWI startups, x.com/Jason. And finally, I'm trying to get to $1 million in startup credits for getstartupcredits.com. This is a gift from me and my team to all startups. We can't invest in every startup. 20,000 people apply for funding from us. So what we did was, anytime anybody takes a meeting with us, we give them the getstartupcredits.com package, which is, I think, over $500,000 in credits. I'm going to get it to a million. I got Oracle in there. I got Google Cloud in there. I got Cruise for accounting, like really stable accounting. I got Vanta in there. I got Oracle. I got Zendesk. I got LinkedIn. I mean, these are the biggest names. I got Embroker. I got Northwest. I got HubSpot. Athena. Go to athenawow.com. Get a free month, I think. So what I'm doing is, the people who are my friends who provide services at an elite level, I'm allowing them to provide something really great to founders. This is my mission, to help support founders in year zero, year one, year two, the hardest years. You go there, you fill out the form, you say what you need. I need accounting. I need hiring from LinkedIn. I need marketing from HubSpot. I need cloud computing. Could be, you know, Azure. I don't think we have Azure in there anymore. Oracle. Or Google Cloud. I need any of those. So if you want to be part of it, just email me, jason@calacanis.com. It's got to be something like legit. If you give away 1 month of your service, like the rack rate deal, don't bother contacting me. It's got to be super generous, like 2 years of the product, 100,000 in credits, no strings attached. And you have to attach an evangelist to it. So the way the Get Startup Credits works is, when they fill out the form, Alex, the founder's contact information, if they opt into it, goes to that provider. So if you say you want cloud, it'll go to the evangelist at Google. It'll go to the evangelist at Oracle. It will not go if you don't click off cloud. So you're not going to have your time wasted. But then you're put in touch with people like a real human being. So
yes, you're
to
not
be
sent
part
to the
of
slush
it.
Pile.
No, you're not just going to get added to a mailing list and get spammed. You have to put an evangelist on it. It has to be a good deal. Anyway, it's an experiment. We experimented in the fourth quarter with it. We had hundreds of people, I believe, come in and fill out the form in the experiment. We had, I think, a half dozen partners. We're going to go to a dozen partners. It's working great. And we'll see you on the next episode of This Week in Startups. Bye-bye.